everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Tonight, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the increasing severity of climate change, what ancient wisdom tells us about the wisdom of trees and their deep relationship with humanity for our survival. My guests from Merksville, Ontario, Canada, Dr. Diana Burchford Kroger. If Jane Goodall is the ambassador for the animal kingdom and Vandana Shiva is the ambassador for seeds, then Diana is unquestionably the global ambassador speaking on behalf of the world's trees and forest. Perhaps no one possesses the wisdom of the forest as Diana. An Irish-Canadian researcher, botanical scientist, medical biochemist, and a study of natural mysticism. She has written extensively on the molecular biology of trees, their medicinal properties, trees' social interactions in the forest, and with other life forms, forest conservation, and the traditional wisdom trees hold for healing. In the past, Diana has held science posts at the Canadian Department of Agriculture and the University of Ottawa School of Medicine. She's a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and was named as a world visionary by UNTI Reader. Her research gardens outside of Ottawa are open to the public, include rare plants from Turkey, Iran, China, and 100 rare types of species from the northern forests in other countries, many that are endangered. Her most recent spellbinding book is To Speak to the Trees, My Life's Journey from Ancient Wisdom to a Healing Vision of the Forest, and the documentary The Call of the Forest, Wisdom to a Healing Vision of the Forest, and also the access that you can have to her is at calloftheforest.ca. Nice to have you with us today.
It's my pleasure. It's lovely to speak to you, Gary.
Thank you. Diana, this past year was one of the major setbacks for the climate change movement, at the economic and political levels especially, and especially in the United States and a few other countries such as Australia. The climate conference in Madrid was a failure. The World Economic Forum at Davos, which had climate change on its agenda, was a joke. It accomplished nothing, and global neoliberalism, capitalism, will proceed as business as usual. There were the wildfires across Australia, the worst in its history, the Amazon rainforests being leveled and turning into a savanna under Brazil's new president. Greenhouse gas emissions from human activities are rising again. Methane emissions from melting permafrost is accelerating and transforming the Arctic rapidly. The oceans are being completely trashed. And finally, we are witnessing the loss of species and plants and animals all over the world. So, and even today, just today, Japan announced 36 new coal-powered plants at a time when the whole world is saying don't, and they're trying to justify releasing those millions of gallons of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean as if there will be no problem with that. That could virtually decimate the entire Pacific food chain all the way up. So, with these setbacks and no real concerted efforts being made by the governments, in fact, the governments, with few exceptions, are working hand in glove with the corporations to protect them. Our president, our Congress, both Democrat and Republicans, have taken money from the special corporate interests, the polluters. As a result, we're told that gas hydrofracking is saving the economy. It is not true. We should put a moratorium on all future hydrofracking and start rescinding all the permits that we currently have. So on the one hand, I'll be quiet and just listen to you. On the one hand, we have something of a phenomena. We have been taught how to believe the propaganda more than the truth. We don't want to have our illusions, especially if they're utopian, or don't worry, science or Silicon Valley will save us. interfering with the reality that we have already passed 14 of the 34 major tipping points. They're not coming back. We've seen catastrophic weather examples. The first Category 6 hurricane ever recorded in the Bahamas just 9 months ago. And yet, not a single thing has been done on the east coast of the United States to prepare people for when that next Category 5 or 6 comes, and it is going to come. We also have Greta Thunberg coming to the United States at the age of 16. And though her message is absolutely important and honest and accurate, the entire machinery behind her is completely manipulative. And I believe that they have used this young idealistic girl to their advantage, because they're into carbon cap and trade. They're into the billions, if not trillions, of dollars can be made by pretending to care about the environment when you're really making money. And there's, you do not get to see all the most important people in the world. You do not get to go to Davos and lecture these multinationalists and neoliberals unless it has been arranged. So on the one hand, they can say, this young lady told us what we need to do. Now our corporations are going to engage. Not a single engagement. They flew there in private jets. They ate Kobe beef. And now they're into making more money using her as a poster child for our concern about the environment, why we should write any check. So the people really interested in saving the world, really doing something, are none of the people at Davos or some of the other people who are getting all the news and sucking all the oxygen out of the air. So with these setbacks and this delusional attitude we live with, and no real concerted efforts being made by governments, how do we change the narrative, and what should the new narrative be that we need to communicate? The forum is yours.
Well, Gary, I'm afraid you're going to be depressing some of your listeners, but it's not as bad as you say, and I'll tell you why. Because there are more people on Earth than there are poor people, ordinary, honest, ordinary people, more people than there are multi-rich people. And the poor people, the general population of the planet, is a working population, and we're capable of doing extraordinary things. The ordinary can become extraordinary. And you're right about Davos. You're right about people like me. I work from my rabbit hole, let's put it that way, my 160-acre rabbit hole with all of my research gardens. I work from there, and I've been plugging against climate change for well over 20, almost 30 years, and I've refused a professorship in medicine to do exactly this, to enable ordinary people to do extraordinary things. Don't look around and look at your neighbor and expect them to do something. You do it. The plate is being handed to you, and we'll all do it together. And when we're doing it together, and while we're doing it together, we're going to have some good times. Really, really good times. Now, I had been told as a young child in Ireland, and that's the book you're talking about, To Speak for the Trees, My Life's Journey from Ancient Celtic Wisdom, because that's what I am. I'm a Gaelic speaker, Pán Gaelingagam. That means that I have the Gaelic world with me, to a healing vision of the forest when I was a child. I'm the last member of a very, very ancient family. And my family's home, my mother's family's home, is the Castle of Ross. And my parents, everybody was killed when I was a very young child. And I was taken into a special wardship in the south of Ireland by my mother's would-be aunts and uncles and cousins. And they were all in their 80s and 90s. And I was taught the Breton laws in Gaelic, and that means Ausgaelga in the Gaelic language. They decided that I was the last child of the ancient Gaelic world. I have a banshankas, that means I have a pedigree of 3,000 years of running banshankas from that time, the time before Christ. And I was taught in a 3-year wardship all of the ancient thinking, the fishoigris, the cures for many, many diseases, and all kinds of mystical things, the triad, the Celtic triad of looking after body, mind, and soul. The body we look after, you and I, all of us do. We have our suppers, and we're very, very lucky to be able to eat. Some of us don't. But the mind and the soul, we forget. But I was taught how to care for the body, mind, and soul. And then I was told in a form of prophecy from people called prophets, but in old Ireland they're called Unfili. The Fili told me of the time of now. The time of now is the time when all of the things you're talking about, Gary, are true. Absolutely, they are true. But those things will be changing, and we're passing signposts for that change. Now, remember, I'm also a scientist with a lot of learning in cardiac ischemia, cardiac artificial blood. I mean, I have many, many arenas of study. And I put all the old knowledge to test in the medical libraries. And they were all right. All of them were correct, except for the odd few that I still have doubts about, like telepathy. I am and I can do a certain amount of telepathy, string telepathy, and I can't give you, as a scientist, I can't give you any explanations for that, because personally I don't have them, but I do know it happens. So at the time of now, there will be more squeezing in the world. People will be squeezed a bit more and a bit more and a bit more. And then there will be a real awakening, and the awakening will come from the children. It's beginning to happen. The children have a ghost in their head, and they do know there are things happening that shouldn't be happening. And people will change. People can change. They can turn around and change and do extraordinary things. And I think now is the exciting time that that can happen. The atmosphere is at 400 parts per million, 400, 410, 412 maybe even parts per million, and maybe a little bit more today. And that's the turning point for the planet. So my answer is in the book, is an extraordinarily simple answer. The planet, as you look at it, needs forests. The forests have been growing on our planet home, our planet Earth, for approximately 400 million years, give or take a number of million. And they have learned to produce seeds. And the seeds are our destiny. And the destiny of the forest is to do something extraordinary for you and for me and for all the mammals on the Earth. The forest produces oxygen. And oxygen is necessary by every breathing creature on the planet. It is called a redox reaction, an oxidation reduction reaction. You, right now, are breathing in oxygen, and then you're breathing out carbon dioxide. But I'd give you an experiment to use. You maybe try stop breathing. Or maybe stop for 20 minutes. Well, you know you'd kill yourself by doing that. So what I'm proving to you is that the trees are very important to you. 60% of all oxygen comes from our trees and our forests on the planet, and it's desperately needed by the planet. But what has happened is our forests have come down. And by downing the forest, the balance of the reaction of photosynthesis, which is the carbon in the atmosphere is taken and broken in half, the carbon dioxide into oxygen, and the carbon goes into trees. We've been building up the carbon in the atmosphere, and we've got to pack it back into the trees. The trees are the only species on the planet Earth that have the anatomy to farm the sun. And they take the photons from the sun, and they do their duty every single day of every single day of your life. And they are very important. So all of these people in Davos, they should walk out of their buildings and look at the trees and understand what the trees are doing in a quantum mechanical reaction with the atmosphere, and they would understand just a little more. And so the people of the planet can do something extraordinary. Ordinary people, even children. You can pick up a shovel. You can take an acorn. You can plant an acorn. And we will plant back our forests on planet Earth. And those forests will drink the carbon dioxide into the body of the tree, and the tree will grow and produce oxygen. End of story.
I'd like to share a little difference of opinion with you, if I may.
Good.
I believe that you're completely correct when you say that we have 7.7 billion people, more or less, on the planet. Mm-hmm. The vast majority are poor. Mm-hmm. However, what all of our history has shown us is that for every 1,000 or million poor people who need and deserve a better quality of life, a better standard of living, there'll be a handful of very wealthy people who only care about having more wealth, more billions, and therefore will not work cooperatively for the interests of those poor. So when it comes to the policies of the land, if we had every citizen plant a tree, just one tree, let's say we ended up with 7 billion trees, that would not be enough to stop the global warming that is increasing, because people, even the poor people, are still eating meat. And those in a developed country like the United States, and I'd like for you to address this in a moment, please, are the most educated, therefore they have no reason to be in denial of the consequences of their own lifestyle, their own overconsumption of everything, towards creating an inhospitable world. And so that's very, very important. You mentioned children engaged in that movement. Well, the one thing that no one paid attention to is when Greta Thunberg said, let's have a Friday strike, good. But it wasn't like a strike where people went out and said to their parents, Mom, Dad, let's clean out the refrigerator, let's clean out the cupboards, and let's start as vegans, a healthy vegan plant-based diet. That would have made a difference. The vast majority simply used it as a day off. Books on veganism are not selling. You hear the word because certain celebrities are now, as image makers, are using it. And I think authentically so. Mm-hmm. But it's not translating into an actual adjustment. What you have is you have the difference between an activist, a person who is conscious of the consequences of cause and effect, like all of our professional class. That's 17 million Americans who are professional, lawyers, doctors like yourself, scientists, advanced education, school teachers. You have 10 million millionaires. Now, if you have two partners, and then you have one child, you're still at over 60 million Americans have the advantage of being able to be a part of the policymaker or opinion leader in class, the ones who actually cause legislation, the ones who run the bureaucracies. These are the technocrats, the ones who have forums on television and radio who can change us. I have yet to see anyone within that class say, you know something, let's stop being a careerist for a moment. Let's stop going up the ladder, and let's start planting trees, going vegan, stop buying stuff we don't need. So clearly there's an addiction in our society to consumerism and corporate greed that have enabled human activity to continue its destruction of the environment, the planet's biodiversity, and in turn increase climate change. A society built on greed, and that's our entire society today, is a society in spiritual crisis. Now, let's circle back to what you said about your own background and your 3,000-year heritage. It is a misplacement of ethics and values to know the truth and not act upon it. If greed can be transformed into something life-confirming, we might have a chance. Please address this conundrum, and are there ways to undermine the culture of greed that is steering the course towards our civilization's demise?
Well, First of all, in my book, I talk about the global bioplan. And indeed, Gary, it's six times that amount. Each person on the planet, it's the global bioplan, each person on the planet, plant a tree, one tree per person for the next 6 years, and we will buy back time to actually redo our ways. So that's one step forward. We can do that. Then the next thing we can do is not just you and I, the whole lot of us can do, is we can make greed unpopular. The vast majority of people on the planet are not very wealthy people, as I've already said. And we can look at the greed and the celebrity culture that is really being pressed upon us, and we can make it a non-entity, if you look at it that way. All the people I know who are super wealthy, all of them, and I do know quite a few, they're absolutely bloody miserable. They're miserable people. So who wants to be a miserable person? Who wants to be hoarding vast amounts of money and afraid that they're being kidnapped and all of those things? No, I think that for all of us, the people on the planet, we have to be grateful for everything we have every day, no matter how small it is, no matter how tiny it is, for a touch, for a smile, for the small bit of food maybe that we have. Then we can start thinking and repairing ourselves by a modality called compassion and a modality called silence. And within the silence of our soul, start thinking about what we're doing. And that silence is either meditation or prayer. There is not enough prayer of all religions on the planet, I think, where we do take the time to think about our souls and to think about our minds and to think about what we're doing. Stop being in such a rush. You're going to get there anyway, so stop being in such a rush. Take your time to think. The children do it, so you should do it. Look at your babies, look at your toddlers, look at your children. They sit down and stick their thumb in their mouth and think. You do that too, without the thumb in the mouth, of course. So you start in a form of contemplation of your own life. And I think then you start thinking about communities, because we never do anything totally alone. We have to do it in the company of other people. Start building your communities. And if you build your community, then you have something marvelous. Value the person living next to you and apply to them an idea that you do to them as you wish they to do to you. So love your neighbor. That is probably the floater that should go around the whole of the planet. Love the people around you. Then start working. Now, Gary, it's not a difficult thing to do to have a vegan veggie. It's simply not a difficult thing to do. Reduce your meat, increase the quality of your food so that you can think better. And if you're going to do that, then you can look at my book, The Sweetness of a Simple Life, because that's a blinking bestseller, and it's used by all kinds of people. It's used by faculty of medicines right now. Just reduce back and use very simple things to cure your body. So that gives you a little bit more money in your pocket, and then you start thinking about the planet around you. You know, all you have to do is have 15% of your population thinking differently, and that creates a trend. The trend for non-smoking now should be used, that pattern of non-smoking should be used as a pattern of eliminating greed and really frowning on greed. Who the heck should want to be greedy? Nobody should. So you just use a bit of common sense in the whole equilibrium, and then the whole future becomes brighter. And as I said, You go out and get a shovel and plant a tree. You protect your forest. You protect your city trees, your city forest. Keep what we have and add to it.
Good. I agree with everything you just said. Now, here is the pragmatist. In the last week...
And you are.
I am.
Yes.
In the last week, two of the leading butterfly conservationists in Mexico were assassinated. In Guatemala, in Honduras, in all these Central and South American countries, those who want to honor indigenous traditions, which, like your own, honor the land and live in harmony with it, they're being pushed off. If you look at Brazil, with
absolute, it's very depressing. I know.
I mean, they're burning one football field every 20 seconds, and already we're seeing the consequences. So when I think of if every person planted a tree, we could save the timeline. However, as a pragmatist, I must also balance the optimism of action versus the cynicism of an activist. Almost all the activists I know are cynical, and they're cynical in a way that is bad. What wasn't it the saying, a cynic is not merely one who reads bitter lessons from the past. He or she is one who is prematurely disappointed in the future. These people live as martyrs. They carry all of the burden of, even when they're, as you said, you've met rich people who are miserable. Well, I've counseled about nearly 70,000 people in my 53-year career, and at least 3,000 are very famous, very wealthy, including members of the royal family, and I've never met such miserable human beings.
Well, they would be my cousins, as a matter of fact, because I'm related to the royal family in England, you're talking about.
No. But I'm simply saying that these are the people who are the most stressed, even though they have almost all the advantages that people who are very poor don't have. So we have to look at it like this. What is the likelihood that someone in Indonesia, where most of the plastic in the ocean is coming from, about 76% of all the plastic comes from the Far East, that they first have to understand the relationship of we humans and sentient beings, so they stop the, like in Bhutan and some of the other countries, slaughtering 100,000 to 200,000 animals a year just in religious sacrifice, and those who are still eating meat, before they get to the idea of maybe I should also clean up in the oceans. So there is an idea that we can episodically select one part of their life and they will transform that part, plant a tree, and at the same time, they're consuming items that are destroying the environment in the other parts of their life. So when I started earlier to say there's a difference between the activists, of which we have millions in the United States, ask any person, go into any college campus and ask every professor, go into any corporate Wall Street firm and say, do you believe in the environment? Absolutely, I believe in the environment. Do you believe we should care for the environment? Of course we should care for the environment. That's an activist. Now, what are you doing about it? That's active participation, and then you'll see that it just drops off a cliff. I would rather have a world of people active in change rather than proclaiming themselves in some virtue signaling that they've wrapped themselves in the mantra and moniker of environmentalism, and yet they're continuing to pollute, like Al Gore and others. So I think we must distinguish what is the reality versus what is not going to happen and what can happen. That said, I know you'd like to speak about your research and discovery showing a deep interrelationship between our coastal forest and the oceans. We're witnessing drastic disruptions to marine life, more and more fish kills, algae blooms, rising acidification, and of course, plastic pollution. Share in depth, please, your discoveries about this interrelationship that has existed for millennia between the forest and the oceans. And when that relationship is completely broken due to the loss of coastal forest, what do you foresee happening to the oceans? And will this be some kind of feedback loop that will further accelerate climate change?
Oh, yeah, definitely it will, yeah. That's a very astute comment on your part, Gary, because that is really true. Let me address, first of all, the butterflies. I think there is a prophecy in Ireland, in old Ireland, and it was there around the time of Christ, that at the time of now, and it's in Gaelic, an Phailacán Avarú Air Vord. That's what it means. The butterflies will be stepped and trodden on in the time of now. And indeed, the two gentlemen who have been murdered down in Mexico, it's more than a horror for everybody, because butterflies are nothing but beauty and pollinators. And the intentions of people to destroy such beauty and such extraordinary ability to pollinate is an anathema to most people on this planet, and it's a fearful thing for a child to think of. I would suggest to people who have money, and there are lots of them, that we have some kind of protective element for these people who are looking after the edges of our nature, that we have something like a SWAT team, that is a rejuvenating SWAT team that can come down and protect these people, because it wouldn't take that much money. And maybe it wouldn't even take that much time until the people who want that land and cut the trees, because it's Pinus religiosa is what they want to take down, maybe it would stop them in their tracks. That would be my suggestion. Now let me move on to the forests and onto the great oceans of the planet. Now, there's a very, very interesting thing going on. And all of you who have taken a walk in the forest, or any kind of forest anyway, north or south, anywhere in the east and the west of the planet, there's an extraordinary thing going on around your eyes and under your feet. As fall and winter comes, the leaves fall off the trees. And they fall off in a fractal pattern of mathematics that is really delineated just like the traffic patterns of the cars that travel on the roads. It's very interesting from a mathematical point of view. Then you stand and walk on the leaves and your children run on the leaves, but you don't know something extraordinary is happening. Within the leaf, within the body of the leaf, you have decay, and you get that kind of funny smell of earth coming from the leaves when they fall on the ground. And everybody recognizes that in the spring and in the fall. It's really quite an extraordinary smell. And what it is, it's humic acid and fulvic acid are being extracted from the leaves, within the leaves, by rainwater, and landing on the ground and landing on the earth under the trees and under the forests. These are huge molecular weight. They're almost a million in the form of their molecular weight. They're huge big molecules that land on the ground. And that's the humic acid that you and I as gardeners are always looking for. But the humic acid is an extraordinary molecule. It's capable of clasping things and holding things in its, if you want to think of it in a word, in its hands. And what this molecule does is that it floats along the land, and the land of the earth, all of the land, the continents, are very rich in iron. And actually Australia is very, very rich in iron. So the land is rich, but the seas are poor in iron, and that's the great balance that's in the world. And so these molecules float along the water, go into the streams go into the rivers into lakes, the lakes into bays, and the bays out into the ocean, carrying this humic acid. And the humic acid on its way has grabbed molecules of iron, and it pulls the iron out into the sea. And in the sea, you may be a child or you may be an older person, but you can't see the great columns of the cyanophyta in the oceans. They're called Crococales, Camasipinales, Nosticales. All of these genera are all in the oceans, and they're out in these great big columns set in place by their molecular weight. The high molecular weight is at the bottom and the light ones at the top. And that floats around as water. It's seawater that you're looking at. But what that stuff is looking for, all of those unicells are looking for iron. And what they need iron for is something really that's an extraordinary thing. In the nighttime, when the sun goes down and oxygenation from the algae starts to cease, then these little tiny creatures start looking for iron. And iron goes into the body of the Nosticales, Camasipinales, and Procognales, and all of these species, and goes into the body, and what it does is it is a catalyst for nitrogenase enzymes that are switched on. And nitrogenase enzymes do something absolutely marvelous. They build protein within these teeny-weeny little unicells. Well, when those unicells are bursting with protein, guess what they do? Like the diatoms and the desmids and all kinds of things like that. They divide in two. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the feeding foundation of the planets, oceans and great seas. And when that happens, everything doubles. That feeds all the zooplankton, all the minnows and all the fish, right up to the great whales. So, if you have something like happened in Australia, where you have these great fires, or California, same thing, you have a great drought on the land because there's very little water because there's been fires. That means the fresh water from the land with the humic acid and fulvic acid is not going out into the oceans, not going out into the seas. So that replication is not happening. That foundational food is not happening. And that makes the whales start to suffer. That makes the mammals and the fish start to suffer. So that's the connection between the forest and the ocean. And in Japan, they have a very, very old saying. I can't say it in Japanese, because I only know one or two words in Japanese, that to seek a fish, you plant a tree. Hey, those people were so, so, so smart, the old people. And that's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. We nowadays, remember, the scientific community only represents 2% of the population, and of that, less again who understand such unique systems on the planet. And our aim, my aim in my documentaries and in my books, and actually, Gary, in all of the things you're doing too, is try to educate people. Because if you educate people and they know the wonder of the world around them, then they start thinking. Then they start moving. Then they get galvanized into action. And I think, honestly, that's the only way.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I'd like to look at your own personal life and spiritual journey that you describe in your book, To Speak to the Trees, mm-hmm. which is truly extraordinary. I was never aware of the amount of suffering you endured as a young girl in Ireland. But it was the ancient wisdom that was retained and passed on by the dying older culture of elders in a certain region of Ireland where the old ways continued that really contributed to you becoming a renowned botanist and biochemist. Clearly, it has been a reason why your own personal relationship towards plants and trees and forest and bees is so unique, except perhaps within the different indigenous cultures. But what is important today is to be able to pass on that intuitive knowledge and wisdom of trees to others, especially the younger generation, just as the elders from your background passed it on to you. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us again a little more about that part of your life, and also add in there, what do you think would happen if you told a child that trees can understand each other? They talk with each other. Older trees use their root systems to nurture sick trees and to educate younger trees. There's a whole dialogue occurring, and only now and in no small measure because of your work, are the larger botanist community paying attention to this?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is, let me kind of just give you a little kind of anecdote about my life in a way, really, as a scientist. First of all, you go into a forest to find your soul. The forest is the cathedral, the green cathedral of all of that is nature. And you cannot go into a forest and stay there for even a little while and come out unchanged. It is impossible for that to happen. And I'm going to prove it to you in another little while and how I'm speaking. Well, let's think about something. Let us think about something that I was trying to do, and that's 30 years ago. I sat down, I refused my professorship in medicine, and I decided, and I refused a whole pile of other things, actually, Nobel Prize teams and all these other blinking people. I thought what I was doing was very important. I wanted to set down a footprint of books that were peer-reviewed so that people can use them as reference books into the future, and I've done that pretty well. I've got one or two more to do, and I've got them written. The idea is that these books are books of science and books that will tell you, guide you in a way towards the right things to do, scientifically speaking anyway. So when I was doing Arboretum America, when I was writing that, I published with the University of Michigan Press, which is a fantastic press, by the way. And they kept saying to me, before they published me, they kept saying, Diana, you've got to find a book just like yours. You've got to find a book, because publishers do that. They want to compare books and see, is this better than that, and blah, blah, blah. So I couldn't find a book. So anyway, there was a man called Bill Heaney who owned all kinds of publishing houses down in New York, and Bill called me up and he said, Diana, do you understand, girl? You can't find another book like yours because there isn't one around. So then what I did is I contacted E.O. Wilson, and E.O. Wilson was a very old friend of some of my family in England. And E.O. did a wonderful foreword for me, and he was so, so wonderful. He has been all of his life so fantastic to me. I can't even say what kind of a treasure that man is. He's fabulous. So I published the book, and in it I was talking about, Gary, I was talking about aerosols. And that is called forest bathing, because I knew about the aerosols from ancient Ireland and, of course, from Japan, too. We're talking Japan here, because in ancient Ireland they had a thing called antignalish, and that is the house of perspiration. And they used forest bathing in ancient times before the time of Christ for healing and curing people. And I wanted to get that knowledge into these books. So what I did is I talked about the lactone compounds and the aerosol moving compounds in the atmosphere that would heal you in the direct ratio your body needed. So, you know, I held my breath, held my nose, and published that book thinking, well, at least I have PhD ideas. And it was peer-reviewed. It has been peer-reviewed by Harvard, as a matter of fact. So I wanted those ideas floating, and I really didn't know whether they would float. Now we see the harvesting of those ideas with forest bathing. And with forest bathing, it is absolutely fantastic. 60% of all of our medicines come from forests. And some of them, like down, you know, the great, great forests down in California, these are the ones like the sempervirens, the redwoods. They produce a compound, taxodione, which flows into the air from the tree's foliage in the early morning and mixes with the mist in the morning. So men, gentlemen, you gentlemen, please listen to me now. You go forest bathing down into the redwoods. Would you please do that? And walk very slowly with your shoulders up. The taxodione lands on your skin, goes into your sebaceous gland, into your system, and gives you a protection to prostate cancer. 9 out of 10 men all over the globe will get a form of prostate cancer if they live long enough. So please do that. If you're lollygagging down in California, will you slip in to the redwoods and please do that for 15 minutes? Then let's look at the the black walnuts. The black walnuts will give you a protection with a compound called ellagic acid. For breast cancer, women should take the leaf, crush the leaf in August, run the leaf on the insides of their arms. It protects you from prostate, from breast cancer. And the nuts are edible, fantastic. 1 pound of walnut meat is as good as 1 pound of the best Black Angus steak. And then you were talking about, you know, vegan meals. For heaven's sake, go and eat and get your hands on some black walnuts and eat 4 or 5 of them every day after your lunch, and you will find you will have a protection to cancers. Then all of the evergreens, the fantastic evergreens, God, I can go on and on about them, in the American woods, east and west of the United States. You have compounds in the air produced by these foliages called alpha and beta pinene. Alpha and beta pinene have got the remarkable, extraordinary ability, and I have just published that myself, to protect the body from all cancers. You go for a walk around those pinenes, those pine trees, and you do it for 15 to 20 minutes. You walk slowly. You breathe deeply. You wear, now I'm not talking you're going naked here. No, listen up here. No, just wear some clothes on, but at the minimum amount of clothes that you can wear so it gets on your skin. Don't go rushing back to your house to have a bath or to have a shower. Just go for the day, keep it on your skin, have it adsorbed on your skin, and then you will have a protection to all cancers for 30 days. Now, if you want to follow up on that, I've just published with the Cambridge Scholars Press the International Handbook of Forest Therapy. It's just out. I've just got my author's copy. It is groundbreaking for protection of you from cancer. Absolutely. The whole of the continent, will you go out and march around the trees and for heaven's sake protect yourself? So 40-60% of medicines come from the forest, and I'm an organic chemist also. You can't manufacture some of these three-dimensional chemists. You know that, Gary. You've got a hell of a lot of training also in the sciences. You can't make them in the lab. You gotta get them right now from the trees. So look, you know, I mean, what we're doing, what all of us are doing, and I'm guilty of that too, is kind of ignoring the obvious. So like, when you get educated, when you educate yourself, when you recognize yourself, that for instance in old Ireland, what they used to do when people got these terrible bronchitis and pleurisy and pneumonia, what you had to do, the medicine people in Ireland, and they were physicians, they made you walk on the heath, on the heathers. And what you did is you broke open the capsular leaves in the heather, and it broke into the air arbutin and methyl arbutin. And that is a natural antibiotic. And it went into your skin and into your lungs, and it had a direct healing effect on your body. So that was going for a walk, not going into the institutions that you're in all of the time. Get out there and go for a walk.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Now, tell us more about the way trees communicate. I think that's always fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, this is just so terribly interesting. It's phenomenal. Actually, God, it's just so exciting. I gave the convocation address in June here to 400 graduating physicists. And what I did is I spoke to them on quantum mechanics. And, you know, you walk under a tree and you find in the tree it's quantum mechanics. Because in the chlorophyll molecule, the photon lands on the chlorophyll molecule and there's an exchange of photon for electron, and bing, bong, the clock goes. And then you have the breaking of carbon dioxide and oxygen in the air and carbon into the tree. My God, you've been walking under these trees every single day and you didn't know quantum mechanics is going on. Anyway, that's the start of it all. It's phenomenal. It's fantastic. But now let's think about something else. inside in a tree, I will ask you to kind of lean up to a tree and kind of know the weight of what I'm doing and what I'm thinking. You have phloem and xylem inside in a tree. And what that is actually, it's like finely tuned fibers going from the top of the tree, and in some cases it's over 300 feet into the air, down into the roots, maybe 500 feet if you're measuring the whole darn thing together. And it's like the strings on a violin. And those strings play, that's xylem and phloem. And from that phenomenon of movement within the canopy, you get infrasound. You get a form of sound waves that actually birds can recognize and elephants can recognize, because actually elephants communicate with one another by infrasound. And I think dogs do it, and I think monkeys do it, because when there are huge weather changes coming, all of the animals are aware of this, and I think it is because of wind and movement within the tree. That is a form of communication. Now, it's the same communication that some children can feel and some people can feel if you go to a wonderful orchestra, if you listen to, like, what you just played at the beginning of this program, the Valkyries, Wagner's Valkyrie. So if you listen to that, you feel that music, the string music in your chest. And for some people, it's a kind of a tightening feeling. And it's a feeling of opening up and actually kind of a glory to the world, in a sense of, oh, God, you just go into the music. Some people can actually feel that, and that's infrasound. That's what you're hearing, and that's what you're listening to. And actually, a lot of people can be trained to hear that kind of energy, big, lopping waves that have low energy in them, but they can travel a great deal of distance. Then, now, ha-ha, we have in the tree something really quite extraordinary. My God, it's just really fantastic. Now, you can pick up a mirror and look at yourself, and you look at your mouth, okay? You've got two lips, and your lips can move. And in a tree, you have, on the leaves, you have, they're called stoma, stomata, stoma, on the leaves. They can be under the leaves or on top of the leaves. And the stoma is regulated by two cells at the edges of your mouth, and those are called guard cells, and those guard cells move by osmotic pressure, which is fantastic. Now, if you've got a little kiddie-widdy with you, if you've got children with you, you take a pine or a fir, a leaf or a needle, and you turn it upside down, and you show the kids the white region of the leaf underneath the leaf. That's a row of stoma. And if you get a decent magnifying glass, you can show the kid the row of stoma. This tree is breathing just like you and me, breathing in and breathing out. Now, you and I communicate by means of speaking to one another, but you know, you and I also communicate by means of pheromones. I produce a kind of a body aroma, let's put it that way. And now stop laughing, because I'm talking about aroma. I'm not talking about any other aromas. The tree produces an aroma too, and it's a form of chemistry. Trees communicate with one another by means of chemistry. It's a chemical communication. And we've just come to understanding that. And that chemical communication happens between the tree and mammals, happens between the tree and you, happens between the tree and its own siblings, believe it or not. There is a closer DNA registration between the siblings of a tree and the tree mother itself. And that tree is called the mother tree. And the mother tree protects her siblings just like you and I would protect our own children. And the mother tree feeds carbon compounds by way of hyphae, by way of tree roots, by way of, it's called the apical root, meristem of the root itself, into the feeding hyphae, and crosses the hyphae into its baby trees. My God, I mean, that is just fantastic thing to even think about. And then if you have a nut tree, nuts produce nut trees produce primary protein. That's number one protein. And actually, that vital protein, that green protein, is better for you than beef protein. And if you are a swanker and you think, oh my God, I'm going to live forever. Well, if you want to live forever, or as long as you think you're going to live, eat plant protein. And you women, if you want to look younger, eat plant protein. And you people who want to be vegans and vegetarians and you think that you are looking better and you've got a better figure, yes, you're right, because you're eating plant protein. So all of us beauty people are eating plant protein. Hey, that's a starter for you. But in the black walnut, something else happens. What the black walnut does is it creates a kind of like a war around in the ground around it. And what it does is it produces a juglone compound. And the juglone compound goes into the earth. And it stops most of the other species from growing around the shadow of the tree itself and to a distance of 100 to 200 feet. That is a chemical conversation that happens between the mother tree and the little baby trees themselves, the saplings under the tree. My God, but you know, there's something else going on, and I wish they had heard about it in Australia. The Australian species the eucalypts. The eucalypts are a huge number, a huge genera of trees, and what they do is they produce eucalyptol into the atmosphere, and it's like a dog going up. It's a chemical conversation with the atmosphere here. Goes up into the atmosphere, and it has got like a pile of tails, like a dog's leg, a whole pile of tails hanging onto the eucalyptol. But that grabs all of those, they're called hydroxyl groups. It grabs all of those hydroxyl tails out of the atmosphere, and it generates rain. So in Australia, they're cutting down the forests and they're getting rid of their rain. They're doing the same thing in California. So this
Diana,
is something that, yep.
Diana, we're out of
okay.
time.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you so much. Just understand you do, but I want the audience that our century is already being defined by a constant, never-ending quest for new human technological solutions to tackle the problems created by the previous human technological solutions. Our industrial civilization and capitalism have brought us to this Anthropocene age, but now we believe it will be geoengineering or artificial intelligence that it will save us. It is not true. And there are huge investments and untold profits to be made by placing our faith into the knowledge of humanity's ingenuity rather than the wisdom of nature and what nature is telling us. So to your new book, To Speak to the Trees, My Life's Journey, I think that's a very important place for people to begin. But just go to calloftheforest.ca and look under Diana Birchford Kroger, and you'll get it all. Thank you very much, Diana, for being with us today.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure, Gary. My pleasure to talk to you.
And you will see her. You'll see Diana in the new environmental film, which I'm told from my editors in New York is being completed tomorrow. So,
congratulations!
Yeah, and you're spread throughout the film. So, I'm sure millions of people are going to see the film, and they'll have a chance to see you in person, and I'm looking forward to the final cut, and when I come back to New York, I'm premiering. I'll see that you get a copy in the next week, all right?
All right. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to that, too.
Okay. This concludes our conversations with the Remarkable Minds today, the increasing severity of climate change and what ancient wisdom tells us about the trees and their deep relationship with humanity for our own survival. My guest, Dr. Diana Birchford Kroger. Kroeger. Have a nice day, everyone.